Our subject this morning is In the Footsteps of the Enlightened. In the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna mentions that an extraordinary manifestation of the divine is born in every age for the upliftment of humanity. Lord Buddha, Jesus Christ, Sri Ramakrishna, Sri Sarada Devi, the Holy Mother, they all fall in this category. And then there are also other extraordinary souls that, who through their own efforts and through God's grace, become established in divine awareness. Such a person also lives exclusively in God. So for spiritual seekers, it's essential that we follow the instructions of these extraordinary masters of the spirit. You know, the Katha Upanishad tells us that the wise proclaim that the way is sharp as the edge of a razor and very difficult to cross, and that we should approach the great ones and learn from them to learn how to access the inner divinity. But sometimes a question arises. Why should we follow someone else's instructions? Why can't we just do it on our own? After all, there are the great Vedic mantras, Tat Tvamasi, thou art that, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman, and so on. We're intelligent and self-directed individuals. There are many instructions and techniques on the internet for meditation and self-improvement just at our fingertips. But here's the snag. You know, it's laudable to be self-sufficient and independent, and our teachers encourage us to stand on our own feet. But when we are spiritually immature, we cannot progress along the path on our own, regardless if we are that or not. Our egocentricity percolates through our personality, and it shunts us into an endless maze of if, ands, or buts. You know, we have heard from Christ that the way is straight and narrow, but the ego's way is never straight. So left to ourselves, there is every possibility of taking a wrong turn, walking in the opposite direction of where we should be going, or getting completely lost along the way. I think we would all agree that we're all searching. The eternal search goes on, and we feel there just has to be something better than what this world can give us. But in our present state, everything is mixed up. Our intentions, our resolves, our desires and our attachments, they're all in a bundle, and they're hard to untangle. We need a way out, but more urgently, we need help. To learn anything, whether it's science or music or art or engineering, IT, whatever, we need teachers. So what to speak of trying to study the subtle science of spirituality? It's even more important. You know, our time on this planet is short. We have no idea how long we're going to be here. So for a sincere seeker of truth, that person doesn't want to waste any time in taking avoidable detours. So I would like to suggest that if we're really earnest in moving forward in our spiritual life, that we should step into the footsteps of the enlightened. Swami Vivekananda said during a course of a lecture on Christ the Messenger that he gave right here in California, in Southern California, "The vibration of light is everywhere. It's omnipresent. but we have to strike the light of a lamp before we can see the light. The omnipresent God of the universe cannot be seen until he is reflected by these giant lamps of the earth, the prophets, the man gods, the incarnations, and the embodiments of God. You know, as Swamiji mentions, we may talk about principles, we can expound theories and philosophy, but every thought and action of ours indicates that we can only understand the principle when it comes to us through a person. We cannot really formulate or understand an idea about something that we have never experienced. Swamiji says talking is not actuality. And I think we could add that thinking is also not actuality. The existence of God cannot be conceived or experienced through discursive reasoning. These metaphysical truths and existential questions cannot be addressed through these means. It's not a matter of intellectual analysis. In this very fine, subtle world of the spirit, the Upanishads tell us that thought, speech, and mind, they turn back. You know, thoughts and ideas can only go so far, but they cannot reach the realm that is beyond thought and speech and mind. So we can only try to grasp these profound truths, enter into the heart of them when they come to us through or demonstrated by an ideal person. The precept is understood only through example. Again, in Christ the Messenger, Swamiji says, you cannot even form a higher ideal of God than what has been embodied and have been practically realized and set before us as an example. Now, this is illustrated in the book, The Imitation of Christ. Christ's examples and teachings are a paradigm for us, which can be universally applied to any great spiritual master. Jesus has proclaimed, I am the light of the world, the truth, the life. I am the way, the door. Now, these could be the words of any great spiritual master. In fact, we can substitute any great incarnation's name for Jesus. In the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna proclaims, those who take refuge in me alone shall cross over this Maya. By that devotion, he knows me. He knows what in truth I am and what I am. Then, having known me in truth, he enters into me. Now, when Krishna says me, he is identifying himself with unlimited cosmic consciousness, the absolute reality. He is not identifying himself with a finite physical form, even though he dwells in a human form, and has a mind and appears on the surface to be like ours. Now, the same thing holds true for all outstanding knowers of God. They are completely free from any limited identity. Their consciousness has expanded into the infinite. So their name indicates a state of being. As Swamiji says, they are a mass of light. In the hymn Kandana Bhava Bandana that Swami Vivekananda wrote on Sri Ramakrishna and is our main arati song, there he describes Sri Ramakrishna as Chid Ghanakaya. And in Sanskrit, Chid, consciousness, Ghana, condensed or solidified, Kaya, body. So Swamiji is telling us that even Sri Ramakrishna's physical body was not merely matter, but was entirely composed of solidified pure consciousness condensed. Now, as difficult as that may be for us to understand the real meaning of Swamiji's statement, Sri Ramakrishna's form, according to him, was divine light and self-luminous spirit. Though appearing human, like you and I, Ramakrishna was existing in a constant state of God consciousness, or we can say divine awareness, where his body existed only as a manifestation of the divine. Although Sri Ramakrishna never used the personal first-person pronoun, he told Swamiji obliquely, he who was Rama and he who was Krishna is now Ramakrishna, but not in your Vedantic sense. Meaning, not in the way that Vedanta says we are all Brahman, we are all that infinite vast existence, one without a second. But that he was a special manifestation of the divine as Rama and as Krishna. Again, he instructed his disciples and through them to us, if you practice just a 16th of what I have practiced, you will surely reach the goal. In other words, do as I have done, follow me. Lord Buddha told his beloved disciples, be ye lamps unto yourself, be your own confidence, hold to the truth within yourselves as to the only lamp. Now, Buddha's main instructions to achieve liberation from all forms of suffering was by practicing the Four Noble Truths in the Eightfold Path: right understanding, right thought, right speech, right action, right effort, right concentration, right meditation, and so on. And he urges us to cultivate mindfulness, ethical conduct, including ahimsa, non-injury, kindness, and compassion. Buddha always emphasized following the middle path in sleeping, in eating, in action, and even in our spiritual practices. He cautions always to avoid extremes. That is exactly what Buddha himself did. He said about himself that Buddha is the name of infinite knowledge. Infinite as the sky. I, Gautama, have reached that state. You all will reach it too if you struggle for it. Sri Ramakrishna says in his homely way that an incarnation is like a hole in a screen. From the finite, if we peep through that hole, we look straight into the infinite. Anyone who follows me walks not in darkness, for that person will have the light of life. These words of Christ remind us that we must follow him, imitate his life and ways, not in letter, but in spirit, if we are to be truly enlightened and thereby liberated from the darkness of our own hearts. The most practical thing that any of us can do is to reflect on the life of Jesus or on the life of any other illumined soul. Anyone who really wishes to understand Christ's or any other saint's words or to imbibe his spirit or her spirit and essence should strive to become like that person in whatever way is possible for him or her. Swami Vivekananda had the highest regard for the book, The Imitation of Christ. He himself translated selections from the first six chapters of Book One. He translated them into Bengali and put them in a Bengali monthly that was entitled Isha Anusharana. Isha means Christ, Anusharana means to follow Christ. Now, along with this translation, he included quotations of parallel passages from Hindu scriptures. A preface to The Imitation of Christ has been published in Volume 8 of the Complete Works of Swami Vivekananda. And in 1997, when Volume 9 was brought out, Swami Vivekananda's footnotes to The Imitation of Christ that give the parallel passages, comments, and an occasional commentary have been included. Now, it's just as an aside, it's pretty fascinating that during Swamiji's wandering days in India as a wandering monk, the only two books that he carried with him were the Bhagavad Gita and The Imitation of Christ. Swamiji says all wise men think alike. The reader, while reading this book, The Imitation, will hear the echo of the Bhagavad Gita again and again. Like the Bhagavad Gita, it says, give up all dharmas and follow me. By imitating Christ or any other enlightened being, by following his or her teachings, we can become like them by assimilating some of their characteristics, such as feeling for others, dispassion, and unselfishness. They've all said that they know the way and that we should step in their footsteps. You know, when Swamiji first met Sri Ramakrishna, he asked him, have you seen God? He asked him straight out. And Sri Ramakrishna's reply was, yes, I see him more clearly than I see you, and you too can have that experience. The ancient Rishi of the Svetasvatara Upanishad declared, I have seen that great effulgent being who shines like the sun beyond all darkness. By following the path that I have tread, you too can see him. These incarnations and mystics and saints are so human and yet divine. That seamless blending of humanity and divinity makes it possible for us to relate to them and through them to the divine within ourselves. The experiences and teachings of holy people are really indispensable in guiding us along the path. Having seen the truth, they speak very simply and directly, reassuring us, infusing tremendous strength and assurance into their words. You know, we can read about these ideas, abstract descriptions in philosophy books, in our scriptures, and of course we do derive a certain understanding. But by studying the lives of illumined souls, it gives us a different, more comprehensive meaning. It becomes alive. Their lives bear out the truth because they are the embodiments of the principles contained in the Upanishads. Swami Ramakrishnananda, one of Sri Ramakrishna's scholarly disciples, said that they could not understand higher knowledge or truth until they came into contact with Sri Ramakrishna. The living touch of the soul coming from the spiritual masters is what makes a deep, lasting impression on our minds and our practical lives. Swami Shivananda Mahapurush Maharaj, another disciple of Sri Ramakrishna, once said to a monk, what kind of scriptures are you reading? Can you read our lives? Our lives are the Upanishads. You will find within our lives the essence of the scriptures. There is much to learn from the various personalities of the different teachers. They vary in the aspects that they emphasize and the nuances of spiritual life and experiences that are manifested in their lives. Now, this expands our exposure It facilitates our ability to respond according to our moods and needs. Not everyone is attracted to the same teacher. But as Sri Ramakrishna reminds us, all jackals howl alike. You know, perhaps we have read about something, a particular incident that reflects a situation in our life, and we see how they resolve their problem. Or through some teachings, we're able to let go of small botherations, to distance ourselves from things or persons or circumstances, to see the bigger picture, which reflects and refocuses our attention on our ideal. For example, in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, once a disciple came to him because he was having a personal problem with someone, and he didn't know what to do. So he asked Sri Ramakrishna his advice, and Sri Ramakrishna told him that he should earnestly try to reestablish a friendly relationship with this person, to try to reconcile their differences. But if that didn't work out, then not to give it another thought and to take refuge in God. There is no use, Sri Ramakrishna said, in giving up God and feeling depressed by thinking about others. Furthermore, positively, we feel uplifted by their practical instructions or the accounts that they give of their experiences, which help inspire and strengthen our own efforts. In some way or other, the enlightened souls provide us a transparent window, you can say, into the world of the spirit. Without the example of such people, we can't really understand the subtle true meaning of the things spoken of in mystical religion, no matter how much we read, how philosophical we may be, or how eloquently we may speak or write. After all, the words are just the outer crust. It's what we are that matters. As Gerard Groot, the author of The Following of Christ, said, "I would much rather feel compunction than to be able to define it." From our ordinary, unenlightened experience, we have no other way of relating to the spiritual dimension within us, or even to know of its existence, because that experience requires knowledge that's beyond our ordinary sense perception or cognition. It requires a different kind of knowing, intuitive, direct perception, timeless thinking, if you will. It actually bypasses the mind, as opposing to thinking within the realm of time and causality, as we are usually accustomed to doing. That living, conscious life, which is bright and self-effulgent, is a transcendent experience and perception that leaves words, ideas, and ordinary thinking, as we've already mentioned, far, far behind. As the Upanishads tell us, by his light, all this is lighted. Hearing our living guru's words, observing his or her character, how he or she lives, or through the study of lives of other great saints, it provides us with a map, like nothing else possibly can, of this uncharted territory. A landscape without familiar reference points. Initially, we are unaware of our divinity, excuse me, but we learn to recognize it in another person. Sister Christine, one of Swami Vivekananda's American disciples, recalled what it was like to be in the company of Swamiji. Daily, hourly, we saw the great ideal of the Gita put into practice in the actual experience of daily life. Through their association, we are given many valuable hints, cautions, and encouragement to simplify our journey. And further, our minds are lifted to a nobler level of thought. So the experiences of a holy person are indispensable in guiding us along the path. They are the concrete, living examples of subtle realities, and this gives us a deeper understanding of the spiritual dimension within ourselves. We are then able to intuit, to get some idea, to get a sense about it, and thereby gain inspiration to try to attain that state ourselves. Again, Sister Christine said that Swamiji drew aside the curtain into the region beyond the life and death and planted in our hearts the desire for that glorious freedom. After all, it is our own true self. The kingdom of heaven is within us. But we need that touch of the soul to kindle the fire in our hearts to turn within. You know, just as we go online to research a particular subject and we find various links, similarly, all of the spiritual masters serve as links to this one infinite truth. To step into their footsteps means to attempt to live as they did. Not in particulars, of course, but in principle. In order to do this, we need to have some idea, some insight into why they did what they did. You know, our teachers caution us not just to accept what we read or what we hear. We should think deeply about it. And I would like to add karma, to act, to implement the result of our reflections and our meditations into our lives. What are the implications of a course of action? What's the thought behind it? In other words, we need to open our hearts and minds to our spiritual master's influence, incorporate their teachings and advice into our lives if we want to live like them. We have to observe these things in another person in order to imitate them. When we study the lives of these great ones, we get a sense of their inner life as it is reflected in their interactions with others and their responses to various circumstances. Swami Turiyananda said, "What is truth, an accomplished fact for a person of realization, is a practice for us." Finally, I would like to mention three things that I feel are necessary for us in our attempt to step into the enlightened footsteps. We need CPR, not literally, of course. We need it as a jump start to sustain our journey. CPR, commitment, practice, and right understanding. First is commitment. Commitment, patience, they're similar, but commitment comes from the Latin word which means to join, to connect, to entrust, to pledge. We have to commit ourselves to our spiritual life. We have to really mean it. When we truly commit ourselves to something, we're serious about it. We close the loopholes. You know, Sri Ramakrishna gave an apt example of farmers who want to irrigate their fields, but who fail to close the rat holes in the fields. So obviously the water, instead of going to the crops, it all drains out through these holes. The mind's scattered, restless nature makes it so easy to let fly innumerable excuses to slack off, to get distracted, or to get derailed. Commitment puts us into a lockdown mold. It closes the rat holes. I'm going to do this even if I fail 100 times. I'll try again. We wholeheartedly enter into an endeavor with no alternative of turning back. When we commit ourselves to follow our spiritual teachers, it presupposes conviction. We have to be convinced about what we are doing and why we are doing it before we can really commit ourselves to it. That following them is beneficial for us. As I mentioned, our teachers emphasize establishing convictions by correct thinking. Otherwise, what's the basis for our practice? It can't be based merely on an intellectual information or some sentiment or emotion alone. It has to go deeper than that, or it won't take root. It simply won't last. They say when we have to refine our intellect so that on a deeper level we can develop a firm grasp of philosophical principles underlying our intellectual beliefs. This is all part of conviction. We should be convinced about the efficacy of the teachings we are following and their relevance in our daily lives. In a lecture entitled Four Pillars of Wisdom, one of our late senior swamis listed these pillars as right conduct, character, intellectual understanding or conviction, and meditation. Of the third pillar of wisdom, conviction, he says that our understanding deepens when we study the lives of those who have attained to that blessed state called God realization, who have demonstrated these teachings in their lives. In other words, when our understanding deepens, our conviction grows. Then we feel, yes, this is the right thing. This is the best possible way that I can live my life. There is no alternative, no turning back to our old ways of thinking and living. Through conviction, our efforts are strengthened, which in turn reinforces our commitment. Otherwise, without conviction, as soon as an obstacle pops up, we're shaken. We're overcome with doubt and misgivings. We're ready to throw in the towel, to give up, just like Arjuna tried to do on the battlefield. Life is a battle. It takes courage. It takes courage for all of us to face the obstacles that inevitably come. Spiritual life is not just smooth sailing. When the obstacles come, we have to have the strength to push them aside and move forward, knowing full well that struggle and confronting obstacles along the way is part of our evolution. It's part of life. The second thing that is important in stepping in the footsteps of the enlightened is patience. You know, we are living during times of mind-warping speed, instant messaging, smartphones that are smarter than we are, super high-speed internet, and even AI. Faster, faster, faster. That seems to be the theme underlying our lives. No one knows where they are going in such a hurry. We are living in a perpetual state of fast forward. The basic nature of the mind of the whole world is turbulence, dizzying, constant change. Sri Ramakrishna used to say, sha, 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 forbear, forbear, forbear. Spiritual forbearance or patience is that stabilizing force that enables us to withstand the irritations, the contradictions, the cross currents of our lives, as well as the interminable waiting that spiritual life requires. Patience is the capacity of calm endurance, remaining undisturbed, unagitated, composed and quiet within as the storm surges around us. So we have to persevere. We have to practice holding steady by remaining firm in the face of life's challenges. The other aspect of patience is that we have to be patient with ourselves. Most of the time, we become impatient with others because we are not patient with ourselves. Making changes in our lives and personalities requires tremendous strength and resolve, and this takes time. It's not a quick fix. Repeated attempts to rise above the demands and obsessions of the body and the mind and try to live on a higher plane of spiritual awareness requires so much effort and patience. The reason is obvious. It's the nature of spiritual life that there will be ups and downs, progress and regress, hope and despair, stagnation and joy. For so many lives, we have been pursuing this world, and now we are trying to turn in an entirely different direction. We are swimming against the current. When we are patient, we are not in such a big hurry to try to correct everyone around us, but we're willing to slow down and focus within ourselves. As Swami Turiyananda wrote in one of his letters, the main thing is to adhere to the ideal with patience. If you can do that, gradually everything will be favorable. Success is inevitable for one who continues with patience. The third aspect of CPR is right understanding. There's the famous Gayatri prayer that most of you are familiar with. Let us meditate on that excellent glory of that divine being who illumines everything. May he guide my understanding. There is nothing more central to our lives than having right understanding. If our understanding is stained or thwarted, we just move in circles. Living like the Great One requires that we have right understanding. Christ tells us, give up all that you have and follow me. Whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever shall lose his life for my sake shall find it. When we have right understanding, we grasp that when we forfeit anything, be it an idea, an opinion, an opportunity, a position, recognition, whatever, when we forfeit that for something that we consider has a greater value, we intuit its true worth. The most precious thing that we can forfeit or sacrifice is our small self, our ego, which is so dear to us at present. But to follow in the footsteps of the enlightened, we have to surrender whatever is small and limited for something far superior, far vaster. And this takes right understanding to determine the difference. Whosoever shall lose his life for my sake shall find it. Such a person lives for others. Swamiji mentions in Christ the Messenger to be unselfish, perfectly unselfish, is salvation itself. For the man within dies, and God alone remains. Right understanding leads us to the bottom line in following our spiritual masters. To be centered in the divine within and loving and serving others as the divine without thought of self. And that requires not only self-sacrifice, but right understanding. I think commitment, patience, and right understanding will take us a long way in trying to take the right steps in following our spiritual masters. The way may be sharp as the edge of a razor and really difficult to cross. But through their grace and their influence, the impossible becomes possible. Let us all join Swami Vivekananda in offering our salutations to all past prophets whose teachings and lives we have inherited, to all godlike men and women presently who are working to help humanity, and to all those coming in the future, living gods, to work unselfishly for others. Thank you. Om Jo Shantir Antariksham Shanti Prithivi Shantir Apa Shantihi O Shadaya Shantir Vanaspataya Shantir Vishwe Deva Shantir Brahma Shanti Sarva Shanti Shantireva Shantihi Same Shantiredhi Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Peace is in heaven, peace is in the sky, on the earth and in the waters, the herbs, the plants, and the trees are all full of peace. The gods are peaceful. Everything in the universe is pervaded by peace. May this eternal, universal peace enter our soul and being. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto us all and to all beings everywhere.